I also have way too many slides for me to go through every single one, but thanks to the previous speakers, they covered a lot of my territory, so I can just, I won't duplicate what they said, just acknowledge. I do have some disclosures. Project Lazarus does have funding, unrestricted educational funds from Purdue Pharma. And I've also, and also from what Dr. Wally mentioned about the naloxone hydrochloride and the nasal adapter being an aftermarket add-on, I will be mentioning that also because that's part of our program. That is Wilkes County, North Carolina, in the western foothills, just below the Blue Ridge. And Project Lazarus is a community-based model implementation for engaging a community to reduce opiate overdoses. And when I say a community, I mean the entire community. We leave no one out, and I'll share a little bit more about that and the reasons why we had to address this in rural North Carolina and acknowledging that it had to be done in a community. And our model is essentially this, with the community being the centerpiece, the community needing to know the knowledge, needing to have awareness, and then what can a community do? So we move into communities with community forums, setting up strategic plans, action plans, all of that for the different components of a community. And I have to say, when we started this in Wilkes County, our health director for the county basically, and she would state today, didn't feel that this was a public health issue. She has since changed her mind. She now sees it's public safety. Last week I spoke to 15 health directors from 15 different counties in our state, and the health commissioner, Jeff Engel, has now assigned someone from his department to be part of our work group to take some things statewide, realizing it is a public health issue and it's affecting the entire population. So this is the centerpiece. All the other things around this that I'll go through quickly could not exist without the community involvement and the community even know that they have a problem. And that's, you know, where we were initially with Wilkes County. And I did this by dissecting our community, Sociology 101, looking at all the aspects of what an individual and how an individual is influenced in any given community and all the different components of that individual. And then dissecting it to, okay, what can the schools do? What can law enforcement do? What can the faith community do? What can peers do? What's our family situation in our county? And then how we can enhance those, how each one can become involved, and just looking at their sphere of influence and saying, well, this is what you do every day. This is what you could just do a little differently to address opiate use, misuse, diversion, and overdoses. And so we have tackled literally every single component of the community and brought them to the table. And of course, the larger aspects of this sphere take a little bit more as far as economics, jobs, you know, and all of that that directly affect a community. And we know that when, you know, jobs are less, money's gone, crime and substance abuse go up. It's a public health issue. These are some of the folks we got to the table, just listed by name, and I put these in here because these are working groups within our working group. You know, the medical community is there, the law enforcement community is there, the school community is there, the news media is there, the Juvenile Crime Prevention Council is there, the Ministerial Association is there, the health department is there, and these all are front and center and engaged. And we've helped them to get engaged by helping them develop an action plan in what they do every day. You know, not trying to get them to meld together completely, but just individually as an organization what they can do. And of course, the monitoring, the epidemiological tracking of what was going on, and that's where kind of all this started. And you can see here in North Carolina, it averages about 11.5 deaths per 100,000. The United States, you know, somewhere about 9.9. And you can see for Wilkes County last year, we were at 46. That's why we had to address an issue, because opiate overdoses, accidental poisonings, these are individuals who do not intend to die, do not intend to commit suicide. They either misuse their medication, abuse their medication. Either way, they took too much, mixed too much, and did not wake up. So you can see we're about four times the national average and five times the, well, four times the state average and about five times the national average for overdose deaths. And this is true for Western North Carolina. It isn't just Wilkes County. We just happen to be the worst. And in 2007, we were the third worst county on a per capita basis in the United States for overdose deaths from prescription drugs. So again, this is, you know, it kind of proves out, this is the awareness factor. You start to show your community these kind of statistics and they have to pay attention. And like I was talking to Alice earlier, nobody can, and someone else. Nobody can duck under the radar when you have this kind of issue in your community. Nobody can escape it, and everybody has to be involved. And we study the different drugs and tracking those over the years, because some of these are population specific. But we're seeing that, you know, heroin and cocaine, those issues, other synthetic opioids, you can see the rise in there over the past 8 years. And methadone, thankfully, over the last 3 years, we are now seeing a trend downward as being the culprit for opiate overdoses when it consistently has been number one, yet it's not the number one prescribed. But it is the most lethal in the accidental poisonings. Unfortunately, I think I have a slide in here. Yes. On this one, it's the other opiates, the methadones you can see going down, cocaine, other synthetic opioids, but now you see heroin is what? Trending upwards. First time. You know, we've now tracked it for 3 years, and we're seeing it trend upwards. And these numbers are probably low. They're probably worse than that. But it's just something to pay attention to, because as we see, opioids seem to trend into, you know, heroin use. And these are some of the drugs, the Schedule 1s, the 2s, 3s, 4s, and 5s. And again, looking at that, you know, and how much is being prescribed in our state. You know, 5.1 million recipients of outpatient prescriptions for controlled substances by schedule, that's a lot of drugs. I can tell you in North Carolina last year, we had 350 million doses of controlled substances prescribed for 9 million people. That's a lot of pills. And that's a lot to deal with that's on the street. In Wilkes County, we had 187,000 prescriptions for controlled substances for 67,000 people last year. That's three per every man, woman, and child of every age, from a newborn to somebody who's 102. That's a lot of prescriptions, you know. And I look in my cabinet and say, I don't have any. So I look at my neighbor and say, how many do you have? You know. So again, we can just see the prescribing that's going on, the utilization that's going on, and the trends that, you know, show the overdoses. And of course, prevention. We're looking at that, you know, on an everyday basis. One of the ways we addressed this early on was chronic pain. Because at the same time we were dealing with the community, the Medicaid community was looking at how many Medicaid patients were overdosing, how many Medicaid patients were being prescribed, how many doctors they were visiting, how many emergency room visits they were having, all from prescription drugs. So we started a chronic pain initiative with the Medicaid folks in Wilkes County, and it was to educate the physicians on pain management. We created a toolkit. We went to the emergency department and said, you know, just a few years ago, we didn't have a pharmacy that was open 24/7. Now we have the Walmarts open for 24/7 and the Walgreens. So on Saturday night at 10 o'clock when everything was closed, we had people standing in line out the door of the emergency room with every ailment you could possibly think of, migraine, toothache, backache, whatever, because they knew they were going to walk out with what? Some pills. So we went to our emergency department and said we need to change policy, and thankfully they did, and I'll get into that a little bit also. We looked at the case management in the emergency department and Medicaid patients. We actually, through a grant from the state and the hospital agreeing, we have an RN case manager that follows all those frequent flyers, getting them, if they're there for chronic pain, they're getting referred out to a primary care physician, or if they're in there for dental work, they're getting referred out to a dentist, and staying on those individuals to make sure that they realize they can't come to the emergency room for routine care. And I can tell you, in 6 months that we started this, the hospital came to us and said our visits are down. And from an economy of scale, hospitals are concerned about that. For us, we said, good. In 3 more months, which was 9 months, the neighboring hospital from the other county called us and said, what's going on in Wilkes? We're getting all your Wilkes residents in our emergency room. Everybody looking for pills. So what essentially happened at the year's end, the emergency department had less visits, higher income, and better excellent scores. Right people, right care, right pills, right medication, and it's beginning to work. The other hospital in the other county adopted the same policy. So it's just perpetuating from there. And then, of course, the pilot study for Project Lazarus would all get into. So some of the goals of that was physician education, you know, how to properly prescribe, how to look for diversion, how to monitor your patient, how to assess your patient, Espert, Gain, and other tools that are available, and not just going along with what a patient is saying, and then, of course, properly monitoring the patient through urine screens, pill counts, and so forth. So we brought that education component in. And I'm sorry I'm going so fast. You can get these slides where you've been instructed. And then, of course, Wake Forest University came in back in the spring to evaluate our chronic pain initiative after 3 years. And so these are some of the questions that they asked of the physicians. You know, to what extent was the toolkit used? You know, how much change did you use in your overall practice? What's the strength and weaknesses? Typical evaluations. So they looked at, you know, one physician from each practice, interviews, 30 to 60 minutes to determine, you know, what exactly did we do or didn't we do in the chronic pain initiative. In this, you can see that the pain contract, the utilization was up. Progress notes, other things, proper prescription writing, flow sheets, logarithms, didn't really make a huge difference. It was, you know, used in somewhat, but we also found out one of the complaints was they want electronic forms and this was not. So we're changing that. So we think that there will be more utilization in that arena, you know, once we do that after the first of the year. But one thing that we did find out among these, you know, the majority of the practices in Wilkes County was that single primary care physician was up. The single pharmacy utilization was up rather than multiple pharmacies. The number of prescribers was better. Phone calls to the physician on chronic pain issues actually went down. It got better. The number of ED visits from those individuals who were in case management went down. Opioid misuse went down. Pain management was better, improvement. And then, of course, the number of pain scripts improved. So all of these factors, we found out we actually changed medical practice in Wilkes County regarding chronic pain management and prescription of opiates. One of the surprise things that we found out when they interviewed patients was the patients actually felt more satisfied, that they had a contract agreement for their prescriptions for controlled substance with their physician. It empowered them to be able to talk about their issue, to feel more free about talking about my pain, I still have pain, and you know, maybe you need to give me something else or up the dose. They felt freer to do that. And it was less confrontational because it had already been an initiated contact between the doctor and the patient on that issue. And then the perceptions among patients about how they need to contribute to their own care and their own pain with that contract. All of those were improved issues between the physician and the patient, and again, everyone feeling more comfortable about a very important issue. Pain is we know, it's epidemic, but then so is opiate use, and we need those two, but they need to be brought together in a safer manner. And of course, some of the lessons that we learned, that the agreement works, it's a good negotiation tool, and the doctors love it because it's less confrontational. The use of the payment agreements increased the brief education. Again, it's that point of stopping, looking, and listening, and being able to discuss the issue. And that's what the agreement does. And the physicians regard our controlled substance reporting system, which is our PMP, our prescription monitoring program. It started in 2007. We have 20% of our physicians, prescribers in the state signed up. In Wilkes County, we have 70% utilizing that system. We went door to door, every CME, every time we had them together, we were giving them information, application, education on how to use it, get them signed up, and they're using it and it's working. And they're finding out that it works for monitoring their patient and it works for those new patients coming in to make sure that nobody is abusing the system. And of course, Project Lazarus comes into this, drawing together the community aspect and the medical aspect, and we have to do it because, you know, not all preventions work. So people do need rescue. That you've already heard regarding the naloxone programs that are already there. And of course, the access to treatment issue is ongoing because we just don't have any in rural North Carolina. It's just not sufficient for the need, but we're working on that. So we reintroduced Narcan, naloxone, the same way the other programs have. We've done it in a way that the patient, the chronic pain patient, the individual who is on opiates, is seeing that physician. The physician is going to be the one to write a prescription for naloxone. They don't have to go to a different center. They don't have to go to a van on the street. And that it's from their individual doctor. We wanted it to become best practice in general medical practice that the safety mechanism of rescue from an overdose and the education is given up front to that person who's at risk for an opiate overdose. And we have a whole list of those who are at risk, and these are some of those. Again, you can see them on your when you look at these. But you know, the history of non-medical use, a high dose of medication, 100 milligrams a day, somebody who's on a methadone for the first time, somebody who was increased in their methadone prescription, somebody who's coming out of jail or detox, they're all at risk for an opiate overdose because their tolerance level, all of those factors have changed. And for anybody who is being prescribed, then we're saying prescribe naloxone at the same time and present to them the educational DVD that we at Project Lazarus, you know, created. So that they have to look at that DVD before they get the prescription, and then in the kit, there's one in that kit so that they can take it home and their peers and families can look at it also, because they're the ones that are going to ultimately give them the naloxone if they need it, and so they need to know the signs and symptoms of an overdose. The medical board for North Carolina agreed with our premise of this, and then they put out this position statement saying, we want our prescriptions, we want our prescribers to prescribe naloxone to those who are at risk, and they're indicating that that is best medical practice. And Project Lazarus is the pilot, you know, to do that. And of course, we're evaluating our program. Last year, those 46, because you know, we're looking at 100,000 populations, there's only 67,000, we had 31 deaths. Out of those 31, 23%, which it averages about every year, 25% had no script history whatsoever, which means they got it on the street. All the rest saw a doctor, got a prescription, and ultimately died from that prescription in some manner or added something to it. What we did find out was in 2009, 75% of those who died from an overdose who had a prescription went outside the county to get their prescription. At the bottom of this, you'll see in 2008, it was 18%. So we went from 18% out of county to 75% out of county. Why? Because our physicians and our emergency department were doing better care, better management, and individuals who were seeking to abuse the system had to go outside the county to get their prescription. In that meantime, did we have some access to care issues? Yes, we did. We had some doctors draw back, but we brought them back to where they need to be right now, and we don't have an access to care issue that if somebody is having chronic pain issues, is on narcotics, they can get care within the county. In 2010, we now have only one person who died got their script from inside the county. 90% got their script from outside the county. So we're seeing that that makes a difference. And you can see on this slide right here, we went from 46 last year, and I can tell you right now that 16 figure is now down to 14. It is not 16. So we have only 14 deaths right now based on 100,000 population compared to our 46 last year. So we're seeing 90% having to go outside the county or abusing the system, and our deaths now are down to, you know, 14 out of 100,000. We're cautiously optimistic. This can be an anomaly. We're being very careful, but we are seeing trends in the right direction in that. So, you know, my goal is that we're going to be below the national average as quickly as we can get there. Other things we're looking at, obviously, if we can do all things right in our county and everybody can go to the other counties around us, we need to do this regionally and statewide and obviously nationally. We're engaging with the Army National Guard. I went to an immersion training, thanks to the folks at SAMHSA, and I played Army for 3 days so that I could learn about military life. And then they talk to us, the soldiers talk to us, their families talk to us about deployment, pre-deployment, PTSD issues, narcotic issues, you know, suicide thoughts, all of that, because public health is caring for those individuals in the population in your communities. Fort Bragg, the soldiers in pretty much the Special Forces in Fayetteville, North Carolina, found out about our program, and we have now initiated Operation Opioid Safe. They have 43,000 active duty soldiers at Fort Bragg, and on any given day, 15% of those are on opiate prescriptions, and they are having accidental overdose issues. So now they are getting naloxone kits to the active duty soldiers and training their families how to reverse an overdose. And that is in force right now. We've had naloxone shortage issues, so we're now finally getting back up and back up to speed on that. The Cherokee Indian Reservation, they have said, Project Lazarus, please come in, we want it, because we're having our teenagers die from accidental overdoses, getting their medicine out of mom and dad's cabinets. So they want that same education. This is who we are, and we're free to help, you know, basically any community. We're getting calls. I hate to talk to almost anybody anymore because it usually means more work, but when 15 health directors from 15 different counties want to sit down and talk about this, I'm going to talk. And we're going to go into those communities and help them because it's a public health issue. We have the rescue medication, and we now have some means with chronic pain management and prescribing methods that can literally reverse some of the situations we have with the overdoses. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Fred. Our next speaker is Denise Osborne, who's a lawyer and an MPH, and Denise is currently working on behalf of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials on a project funded by SAMHSA CSAT. ASTO is also partnering with the National Association of State Drug Abuse Directors and ATOD on this project. Thank you.
Just 1 second. Maybe I'll go here instead. Good sigh of relief. All right, I made it. Hi. Good afternoon. I'm very happy to be here. Today I'm just going to touch briefly on who is ASTHO, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, who I work for, who our members are, some of our past work pertaining to the topic area that we've been discussing this morning, a current project that Ann just referenced that we are very privileged and happy to be working on with SAMHSA and others, and then just a brief statement on sort of what we'd like to do in the future as an organization. So this is a quick snapshot of who our board of directors are. And our current president, John Auerbach, just stepped into his presidency October 21st in Colorado Springs. Our immediate past president is from Arkansas, Paul Halverson. And the president-elect for who will serve after John Auerbach is David Lakey. Mary Selecki is from Washington State. She's a past president, has been a president several times for ASTHO. So who are we? Who are our members? Our members are political appointees. They're appointed by the governor. They are physicians, epidemiologists, nurses, scientists, and other public health people with a sort of varied background. But their primary charge often in the state is to run the state health agency. Sometimes they have oversight responsibility for additional state agencies. However, I think that their primary focus is to really try and implement the policy agenda that is set forth by the governor. So one of our past presidents whose picture is not here is David Sunwall from Utah. And so it's interesting to see the connection as we heard a little bit about the statistics coming out of Utah. And again, we are poised because our current president is from Massachusetts. So I'm going to make sure that I leverage that as much as I can in my department. Here's a quick slide just to give you a feel for some of our regional representatives. The names at the bottom are health officials and where they're from. And this is the way we sort of divide the nation. It's congruent or consistent with the way that the Health and Human Services divides the nation so that we can do our work in a way that's compatible and consistent with the federal agency's approach. So quickly, we like to sort of show this slide almost every time that we talk about ASTHO, just to sort of drive home the point that there are 30 state health agencies that literally represent 55% of the U.S. population. And so our members directly provide all or some public health services at the local, community, state, and federal level. So our members are uniquely poised to really sort of work across the system from local up to federal. Last year, I had the privilege of staffing our president, Dr. Paul Halverson from Arkansas, and he decided that injury prevention was going to be the major focus for our membership. So we did lots of work around injury prevention. He asked all of the members personally to adopt one policy strategy that would help their state sort of push injury prevention, essentially. And we had 34 state health officials that signed up to do something in the area of injury prevention. And for the month of August and September, we focused our entire membership on substance abuse and suicide issues, as well as unintentional poisonings. And this little chart just really shows you the focus of our technical support and our website around injury prevention. So from November 2009 through October 2010, here are the different sort of topics we focused on. And again, I have the pink boxes. So it was exciting to take 60 days and literally speak to our members about substance abuse and unintentional poisonings in a variety of different ways. A couple of years ago, in fact, ASTHO published a short publication, co-branded it with the CDC. And SAMHSA asked me to come and speak to a group of representatives from the states about what we did 2 years ago around this issue. It was interesting because our executive director was asking, why are so many people dying from prescription drug overdose? And he asked our membership that question about 2 or 2.5 years ago. I wasn't with ASTHO, my predecessor worked on this project. But essentially what we did, because we were so passionate around this issue, is interviewed several health officials saying, look at what's going on. Look at the people that are dying unnecessarily. What can we do as an organization, as state health officials, uniquely poised? We have the ear of the governor. What can we do? And so this dialogue began literally more than 2 years ago with an ask, though. I'm very proud of that, and I want to sort of move that forward to the extent that I can. So what's happening today? Today, ASPO, again, has the privilege of working with SAMHSA, Nick Reuter, and Bob Lubrin, and others at NASADAD to sort of take on this sort of targeted project. And so what are we doing? Well, we convened an expert panel on September 17th of this year, and we had very good representation nationally. And Fred served as our co-chair. We had lots of statistics from Massachusetts and from Pennsylvania as well. And Nick and Ann, of course, were there. And so we all sort of talked about what are the best practices? You know, what's going on nationwide? What kind of information do we want to package in a toolkit and disseminate to patients, family, caregivers, and OTP staff? What do we want to say? And so much of what we talked about was very similar to the information we heard from Massachusetts, from Fred as well, and from Pittsburgh. How do you spot an overdose? What do you do? How do you use naloxone? How can we package that information, disseminate it through ASTHO, NASADAD, and SAMHSA nationwide, so that the entire nation has the benefit of understanding all the good information, really, that we've heard about today? So this is just a little more on what we did on September 17th, and we had representation not only from federal agencies, but also from patients, family members, academia, health literacy experts. We talked a lot, we had lots of presentations, we looked at examples of toolkits from several states, we looked at the results of an environmental scan that had been taking place. We really want to take a very serious look at how this information can be messaged, how it's being messaged, and how we can put together a toolkit that reflects the right kind of information in the right way. So this is just sort of on a high level basis what our objectives are around this toolkit that we're putting together. We really sort of are thinking it's going to be four modules, probably fairly short. Again, we're taking a very close look at how Massachusetts is approaching the educational materials that they disseminate, New Mexico, Utah, Pennsylvania, and others. Again, taking a very close look about how to message the use of naloxone, and we'll be calling upon Dr. Wally, I'm sure, often in the near future. So as we know, bystanders can be trained to recognize an overdose, and naloxone, you know, needs to be readily available. How can ASTHO as an organization work collaboratively with the right partners to really disseminate this information to the right audience? So as soon as we get this toolkit sort of underway and reviewed properly and then disseminated, and we do anticipate it'll probably happen, I would say, within 8 months maximum, maybe 10. Beyond that, I think that, you know, ASTHO is looking for more opportunities. And, you know, our executive director, again, is very passionate about this project. So we come at this from a policy perspective. We look at the state policies, the laws that are available to the states, to what extent have they been helpful. We, I think, in the future would like to think about how we can work with our membership to evaluate state policies and to help the states prioritize state policies. So we're going to continue the dialogue with SAMHSA and others to see how we can approach the problem from that perspective. So thank you for having me today, and I look forward to our future work together. I feel very, very honored. Thanks.
Thank you, Denise. Does anyone have a question? We have a couple minutes for questions. And yes, Sandy.
Hi.
Hi.
Withdraw when they don't can't get heroin.
So the question is, what is the relationship between heroin and other opiates as they see it in states in the field? Who would like to start? Alice, looks like. If you would come up here just because they're recording this, thank you.
I think that the relationship is fluid, that it probably goes back and forth. One issue that's a concern is if we're successful on a national level in reducing diversion of prescription opioids, we may see an increase in heroin use. I don't know. I think there's a new formulation of OxyContin that's on the market now that's supplanted the old type that's a lot harder for people to either snort or inject. So the question is that if, and there are people who say that that's their drug of choice, OxyContin, and that they typically inject OxyContin and that they prefer that to heroin, which makes sense on a lot of levels because you always know what's in it. You don't have variable dosage or purity or those kind of things. So if that's what you usually do and you're not able to do that anymore because the new formulation forms into a gel if it's mixed with water, what are the most likely options, I would think, are either taking it orally, which is how it's intended to be taken, or injecting heroin. Those seem like the most likely things to me. So that is somewhat concerning if it goes in the direction of heroin. I would suspect that if it were harder to get heroin and easier to get prescription opioids, that people might be more likely to use those instead, which from a harm reduction perspective would be actually preferable because heroin is so variable in the dose, it's cut with different things. If it's the injection risks, those sort of things. So I think it's a complex relationship.
Alex, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to say about, Nick mentioned that marijuana is still the key gateway drug. I think that prescription opioids are a physiologic gateway to opioid dependence. I mean, there's opioid dependence, which is there's physical dependence that's involved in it usually. So if you have a teenager who is using marijuana and they don't get marijuana and they can't get it anymore, they're not necessarily going to go out and use heroin to replace that craving that they might have for the marijuana. But if you switch the marijuana with Vicodin, which is what's happening more and more in many communities across the country, is that, you know, the use of there's tolerance and then accelerated use. So one Vicodin on one weekend at one teenage party will sometimes lead to multiple Vicodins on the next weekend, and then in between weekend use, and so you've got daily opioid use. And then it gets difficult to get Vicodin anymore or other prescription opioids. And what the person's left with is a feeling of illness like they've never had before. And that's when the heroin dealer steps in. And so it's a powerful gateway in a way that other drugs like marijuana are not. And so there's a tight link, and we see that. Now, if there's always availability of prescription opioids and that's how people started, they'll often stick with prescription opioids. Or if there's no heroin around, which is what occurs like in Wilkes County, at least initially, people will stay with prescription opioids. But that's how I see the relationship.
Thank you. I want to thank we have just one more. We're over, so we can take one more question. But Sandy, that was a great question. Thank you. Yeah, Steve.
All right. Actually, adding on to this, some information from New York, the medical director of the state agency OASIS, Dr. Kipnis, that in 2008 or 2009, there were more heroin overdose deaths on Long Island from 18 to 25 than there were motor vehicle deaths.
Thank you, Steve. And with that, I want to thank everyone for coming. And we look forward to seeing you next year, where we'll have more on this topic. Thank you.